was coated with antibodies, which attached themselves to the molecule of interest, creating a microscopic sandwich. The robot's last step was to aspirate reagents from yet another tube in the cartridge. When the reagents came into contact with the microscopic sandwiches, a chemical reaction occurred that emitted a light signal. An instrument inside the reader, called a photomultiplier tube, then translated the light signal into an electrical current. The molecule's concentration in the blood, what the test sought to measure, could be inferred from the power of the electrical current, which was proportional to the intensity of the light. This blood testing technique was known as a chemiluminescent immunoassay. In laboratory speak, the word assay is synonymous with blood test. The technique was not new. It had been pioneered in the early 1980s by a professor at Cardiff University. But Tony had automated it inside a machine that, though bigger than the toaster-size Theranos 1.0, was still small enough to make Elizabeth's vision of placing it in patients' homes possible. And it only required about 50 microliters of blood. That was more than the 10 microliters Elizabeth initially insisted upon, but it still amounted to just a drop. By September 2007, 4 months after he'd started building it, Tony had a functioning prototype. One that performed far more reliably than the bulky system Ed Koo was still laboring on in another part of the office. Tony asked Elizabeth what she wanted to call it.
"We tried everything else and it failed, so let's call it the Edison," she said.
What some employees had taken to derisively calling the glue bot was suddenly the new way forward. And it now had a far more respectable name, inspired by the man widely considered to be America's greatest inventor. The decision to abandon the microfluidic system in favor of the Edison was ironic, given that Theranos had just filed a lawsuit to protect the intellectual property underpinning the former. It was also bad news for Ed Koo. One morning a few weeks before Thanksgiving, Ed and his engineers were called into a conference room, one after the other. When it was Ed's turn, Tony, a human resources manager named Tara Lencioni, and the lawyer Michael Esquivel informed him that he was being let go. The company was heading in a new direction, and it didn't involve what he was working on, they said. Ed would have to sign a new non-disclosure and non-disparagement agreement if he wanted to get his severance. Lencioni and Esquivel walked him to his workspace to retrieve a few personal belongings and then escorted him out of the building. About an hour later, Tony glanced out the window and noticed that Ed was still standing outside, his jacket slung over his arm, looking lost. It turned out he hadn't driven his car to the office that morning and was stranded. This was before the days of Uber, so Tony went to find Shanok and, knowing that they were friends, asked him to drive Ed home. Shanok followed Ed out the door 2 weeks later, albeit on friendlier terms. The Edison was at its core a converted glue robot, and that was a pretty big step down from the lofty vision Elizabeth had originally sold him on. He was also unsettled by the constant staff turnover and the lawsuit hysteria. After about 3.5 years, it felt like time to move on. Shanok told Elizabeth he was thinking of going back to school, and they agreed to part ways. She organized an office party to see him off. Theranos's product might no longer be the groundbreaking, futuristic technology she'd envisioned, but Elizabeth remained as committed as ever to her company. In fact, she was so excited about the Edison that she started taking it out of the office almost immediately to show it off. Tony quipped to Dave that they should have built 2 before telling her about it. Jokes aside, Tony was a bit uncomfortable with her haste. He'd had a basic safety review done to make sure it wouldn't electrocute anyone, but that was about the extent of it. He wasn't even sure what sort of label to put on it. The lawyers weren't of much help when he asked them, so he looked up Food and Drug Administration regulations on his own and decided that a
"For research use only" sticker was probably the most appropriate. This was not a finished product, and no one should be under the impression that it was, Tony thought. Chapter 3. Apple Envy. For a young entrepreneur building a business in the heart of Silicon Valley, it was hard to escape the shadow of Steve Jobs. By 2007, Apple's founder had cemented his legend in the technology world and in American society at large by bringing the computer maker back from the ashes with the iMac, the iPod, and the iTunes Music Store. In January of that year, he unveiled his latest and biggest stroke of genius, the iPhone, before a rapturous audience at the Macworld Conference in San Francisco. To anyone who spent time with Elizabeth, it was clear that she worshipped Jobs and Apple. She liked to call Theranos' blood testing system the iPod of healthcare, and predicted that, like Apple's ubiquitous products, it would someday be in every household in the country. In the summer of 2007, she took her admiration for Apple a step further by recruiting several of its employees to Theranos. One of them was Anna Areola, a product designer who'd worked on the iPhone. Anna's first meeting with Elizabeth was at Coupa Cafe, a hip coffee and sandwich place in Palo Alto that had become her favorite haunt outside the office. After filling her in on her background and her travels to Asia, Elizabeth told Anna she envisioned building a disease map of each person through Theranos' blood tests. The company would then be able to reverse engineer illnesses like cancer with mathematical models that would crunch the blood data and predict the evolution of tumors. It sounded impressive and world-changing to a medical neophyte like Anna, and Elizabeth seemed brilliant. But given that Anna would be leaving behind 15,000 Apple shares if she joined Theranos, she wanted to get her wife Corinne's opinion. She arranged to meet Elizabeth again in Palo Alto, this time with Corinne present. Any hesitations she had were put to rest when Elizabeth made a big impression on Corinne, too. Anna joined Theranos as its chief design architect. This mostly meant she was responsible for the overall look and feel of the Edison. Elizabeth wanted a software touchscreen similar to the iPhones and a sleek outer case for the machine. The case, she decreed, should have two colors separated by a diagonal cut, like the original iMac. But unlike that first iMac, it couldn't be translucent. It had to hide the robotic arm and the rest of the Edison's innards. She'd contracted out the case's design to Yves Behar, the Swiss-born industrial designer whose reputation in the Valley was second only to Apple's Johnny Ive. Behar came up with an elegant black-and-white design that proved difficult to build. Tony Nugent and Dave Nelson spent countless hours molding sheet metal in an attempt to get it right. The case wouldn't conceal the loud noises the robotic arm made, but Anna was satisfied that it would at least make the device presentable when Elizabeth took it out on demos. Anna felt that Elizabeth could use a makeover herself. The way she dressed was decidedly unfashionable. She wore wide gray pantsuits and Christmas sweaters that made her look like a frumpy accountant. People in her entourage, like Channing Robertson and Don Lucas, were beginning to compare her to Steve Jobs. If so, she should dress the part, she told her. Elizabeth took the suggestion to heart. From that point on, she came to work in a black turtleneck and black slacks most days. Anna was soon joined at Theranos by Justin Maxwell and Mike Bowerly, two other recruits hired to work on the design of the Edison software and other parts of the system that patients would interact with, like the packaging for the cartridges. Anna and Justin had worked together at Apple and knew Mike through his girlfriend, who had been a colleague of theirs there. It wasn't long before the Apple transplants began noticing that Elizabeth and Theranos had their quirks. Anna would arrive early every morning for a daily 7:30 meeting with Elizabeth to update her on design issues. When she pulled her car into the parking lot, Anna would find her jamming to loud hip-hop music in her black Infiniti SUV, the blonde streaks in her hair bouncing wildly. One day, as Justin walked into her office to update her on a project, Elizabeth motioned him over excitedly, saying she wanted to show him something. She pointed to a 9-inch-long metal paperweight on her desk. Etched on it was the phrase, "What would you attempt to do if you knew you could not fail?" She'd positioned it so the words were facing her and clearly found it inspiring. Having an idealistic boss wasn't a bad thing, but there were other aspects of working at Theranos that were less pleasant. One of them was having to do daily battle with Matt Bissell, the head of IT, and his sidekick, Nathan Lortz. Bissell and Lortz had the company's computer network set up in such a way that information was split into silos, hampering communication between employees and departments. You couldn't even exchange instant messages with a coworker. The chat ports were blocked. It was all in the name of protecting proprietary information and trade secrets, but the end result was hours of lost productivity. The situation got so frustrating that Justin stayed up late one night and wrote a long email screed to Anna about it. "We have lost sight of our business objective. Did this company set out to put a bunch of people in a room and prevent them from doing illegal things? Or did it set out to do something amazing with the best people as quickly as possible?" he fumed. Justin and Mike also got the distinct impression that Bissell and Lortz were spying on them and reporting their findings back to Elizabeth. The IT team always wanted to know what programs they were running on their computers, and at times turned suspiciously friendly in what felt like transparent attempts to elicit seditious gossip. The snooping wasn't confined to the IT guys. Elizabeth's administrative assistants would friend employees on Facebook and tell her what they were posting there. One of the assistants kept track of when employees arrived and when they left, so that Elizabeth knew exactly how many hours everyone put in. To entice people into working longer days, she had dinner catered every evening. The food often didn't arrive until 8 or 8:30, which meant that the earliest you got out of the office was 10. The strange atmosphere got even stranger when the Theranos board convened once a quarter. Employees were instructed to appear busy and not to make eye contact with the board members when they walked through the office. Elizabeth ushered them into a big glass conference room and pulled down the shades. It felt like CIA agents conducting secret debriefings with an undercover operative. One evening, Anna gave Justin and Aaron Moore, one of the engineers, a ride back to San Francisco. Aaron had dropped out of a PhD program in microfluidics at MIT and come to work at Theranos in September 2006 after spotting a small job ad in a trade publication. He'd worked at the company nearly a year by the time Anna and Justin came on board. Aaron was smart enough to have gone to college at Stanford and grad school at MIT, but he didn't take himself too seriously. He was originally from Portland, Oregon, and had the Portlandian hipster's look. Shaggy hair, a 3-day beard, and earrings. He was also witty, all of which made him the one person at Theranos the Apple transplants could relate to. Anna, Justin, and Aaron all lived in San Francisco and commuted by car or train to the office. During their drive home that evening, Aaron shared some gripes he had with his new colleagues as they sat in traffic in Anna's Prius. In case they hadn't noticed yet, people were constantly getting fired at Theranos, Aaron told them. Anna and Justin had definitely noticed. The Ed Koo layoffs had just taken place. In addition to Ed, 20 other people had lost their jobs. It happened so fast that Ed had left a bunch of work tools behind, including a nice set of X-Acto precision cutting knives that Justin had fished out of a wastebasket and claimed as his own. Aaron mentioned that he was also troubled by the study with cancer patients in Tennessee. They'd never gotten the microfluidic system anywhere close to working properly, and certainly not well enough to use on live patients, and yet Elizabeth had pushed ahead with the study. The shift to the new machine Tony built was an improvement, but Aaron felt they still didn't have a good read on its performance. The engineering and chemistry groups weren't communicating. Each was running tests on the parts of the system it was responsible for, but no one was conducting overall system tests. Anna listened with rising unease. She'd assumed Theranos had perfected its blood testing technology if it was going to be used on patients. Now Aaron was telling her it was still very much a work in progress. Anna knew the Tennessee study involved people dying of cancer. It bothered her to think they might be used as guinea pigs to test a faulty medical device. What Anna and Aaron didn't know, and what might have allayed their concerns somewhat, is that the test results Theranos generated from the cancer patient's blood would not be used to make any changes to their treatments. They were to be used only for research purposes, to help Pfizer assess the effectiveness of Theranos' technology. But that was never clear to most Theranos employees because Elizabeth never explained the terms of the study. The next morning, Anna reached out to the person who'd introduced her to Theranos, her former Apple colleague Avi Tivanian. Avi was on Theranos' board of directors. He was the one who'd put out feelers to Anna several months earlier and arranged for her to meet Elizabeth. Anna met Avi at a Pete's Coffee in Los Altos and mentioned what she'd learned from Aaron Moore. She worried that Theranos was crossing an ethical line with the Tennessee study. Avi listened intently and told Anna he was beginning to have doubts of his own about the company. Avi was one of Steve Jobs's oldest and closest friends. They'd worked together at Next, the software company Jobs created after being ousted from Apple in the mid-1980s. When Jobs returned to Apple in 1997, he'd brought Avi over with him and made him the head of software engineering. A grueling decade later, Avi had called it quits. He'd made more money than he knew what to do with and wanted to enjoy more time with his wife and two kids. A few months into his retirement, a headhunter recruiting new directors for Theranos had approached him. Like Anna, Avi's first meeting with Elizabeth had been at Coupa Cafe. She'd come across as a bright young lady who was passionate about what she was doing, exactly the qualities you looked for in an entrepreneur. Her eyes had lit up when he volunteered some pieces of management wisdom he'd learned at Apple. His long association with Jobs seemed an object of fascination to her. After their encounter, Avi had agreed to join the Theranos board and bought $1.5 million of company stock in its late 2006 offering. The first couple of board meetings Avi attended had been relatively uneventful, but by the third one, he'd begun to notice a pattern. Elizabeth would present increasingly rosy revenue projections based on the deals she said Theranos was negotiating with pharmaceutical companies, but the revenues wouldn't materialize. It didn't help that Henry Moseley, the chief financial officer, had been fired soon after Avi became a director. At the last board meeting he'd attended, Avi had asked more pointed questions about the pharmaceutical deals and been told they were held up in legal review. When he'd asked to see the contracts, Elizabeth had said she didn't have any copies readily available. There were also repeated delays with the product's rollout, and the explanation for what needed to be fixed kept changing. Avi didn't pretend to understand the science of blood testing. His expertise was software. But if the Theranos system was in the final stages of fine-tuning, as he'd been told, how could a completely different technical issue be the new holdup every quarter? That didn't sound to him like a product that was on the cusp of commercialization. In late October 2007, he attended a meeting of the board's compensation committee. Don Lucas, the board's chairman, told the committee members that Elizabeth planned to create a foundation for tax planning purposes and wanted the committee to approve a special grant of stock to it. Avi had noticed how much Don doted on Elizabeth. The old man treated her like a granddaughter. A portly gentleman with white hair who liked to wear broad-rim hats, Don was in his late 70s and was part of an older generation of venture capitalists who approached venture investing as if it were a private club. He'd mentored one famous entrepreneur in Larry Ellison. In Elizabeth, he clearly thought he'd found another. Except Avi didn't think it was good corporate governance to do what Elizabeth wanted. Since she would control the foundation, she would also control the voting rights associated with the new stock, which would increase her overall voting stake. Avi didn't think it was in other shareholders' interest to give the founder more power. He objected. 2 weeks later, he received a call from Don asking if they could meet. Avi drove to the old man's office on Sand Hill Road. Elizabeth was really upset, Don informed him when he got there. She felt he was behaving unpleasantly during board meetings and didn't think he should be on the board anymore. Don asked if he wanted to resign. Avi expressed surprise. He was just fulfilling his duties as a director. Asking questions was one of them. Don agreed and said he thought Avi was doing an excellent job. Avi told Don he wanted to take a few days to think things over. When he got back to his house in Palo Alto, he decided to go back and look at all the documents he'd been given over the previous year as a board member, including the investment materials he'd received before he bought his shares. As he read them over, he realized that everything about the company had changed in the space of a year, including Elizabeth's entire executive team. Don needed to see these, he thought. In the meantime, Anna Ariola was getting antsy. Anna was by nature excitable. She spoke quickly and was a constant whirlwind of activity. Most of the time, it was positive energy that she channeled into her work to great effect. But at times, it could also turn into stress, anxiety, and drama. After their coffee, she'd stayed in contact with Avi and had learned from her former Apple colleague that Elizabeth wanted him off the board. She didn't know what had prompted their rift, but it was an ominous development. Anna's own relationship with Elizabeth was deteriorating. Elizabeth didn't like being told no, and Anna had done so on several occasions when she'd found a demand Elizabeth made unreasonable. She was also getting put off by her secrecy. A designer might not be as crucial to this little enterprise as an engineer or a chemist, but she still needed to be in the information loop about the product's development to do her job properly. Yet Elizabeth kept Anna on a need-to-know basis. During one of their early morning meetings, Anna confronted Elizabeth with what she'd heard from Aaron Moore about problems with the Theranos system. If they were still working out kinks in the technology, wasn't it preferable to put the Tennessee study on pause and concentrate on fixing the problems first? They could always restart it once they got the machine working reliably, she told her. Elizabeth flatly rejected the idea. Pfizer and every other big drug maker wanted her blood testing system, and Theranos was going to be a great company, she said. If Anna wasn't happy, then perhaps she should reflect on whether this was the right place for her.
Think about it and then tell me what you want to do, she said.
Anna went back to her desk and stewed for several hours. She couldn't shake the thought that forging on with the Tennessee study wasn't the right thing to do. The fact that Elizabeth wanted Avi to leave the board was also unsettling. Anna trusted Avi and considered him a friend. If Avi and Elizabeth had a beef, she was inclined to side with Avi. By mid-afternoon, Anna had made up her mind. She wrote up a brief resignation letter and printed out two copies, one for Elizabeth and one for HR. Elizabeth was out of the office by then, so she slipped the letter under her door. On her way out, she typed out a quick email to let her know where to find it. Elizabeth emailed her back 30 minutes later, asking her to please call her on her cell phone. Anna ignored her request. She was done with Theranos. Don Lucas didn't use email. He'd seen his share of litigation over the years,
including a wave of class-action lawsuits targeting Oracle in the early 1990s, and didn't like the idea of leaving behind an electronic paper trail that might one day be used against him in court. If Avi wanted Don to see what he'd found, he'd have to show it to him in person. He reached out to Don's two assistants and set up another meeting. On the appointed day, Avi showed up at Don's office with hard copies of all the documents he had been given as a Theranos director. It amounted to hundreds of pages. Taken together, they betrayed a series of irreconcilable discrepancies, he told Don. The board had a problem on its hands, he said. It was possible Theranos could be fixed, but it wasn't going to happen the way Elizabeth was managing things. He suggested they bring in some adult supervision.
Well, I think you should resign, Don replied. He quickly added, What are you planning to do with that stack of papers?
Avi was taken aback. Don didn't even seem interested in hearing him out. The older man seemed concerned only with whether he was going to escalate the matter to the full board. After turning the situation over in his mind for a few moments, Avi decided to stand down. He'd retired from Apple for a reason. He didn't need the aggravation.
Okay, I'll resign and I'll leave these papers with you, he said.
As Avi got up to leave, Don said there was something else they needed to discuss. Shanok Roy, Theranos' first employee and de facto co-founder, was leaving the company and selling most of his founder's shares back to Elizabeth. She needed the board to waive the company's rights to repurchase the stock. Avi didn't think that was a good idea, but told Don to have the board vote the motion without him since he was resigning.
One more thing, Avi, Don said. I need you to waive your own rights to buy the shares.
Avi was starting to get ticked off. He was being asked to put up with a lot. He told Don to have Michael Esquivel, Theranos' general counsel, send over the requisite documents. He would review them, but made no promises. When the documents arrived, Avi read them carefully and concluded that, once the company itself waived its rights to repurchase Shanok's shares, it was entirely within his and other shareholders' rights to buy some of them. He also noticed that Elizabeth had negotiated a sweetheart deal. Shanok was willing to part with his 1.13 million shares for $565,000. That translated to 50 cents a share, an 82% discount to what he and other investors had paid more than a year earlier in Theranos' last funding round. Some discount was warranted because Avi's shares were preferred shares with higher claims on the company's assets and earnings, while Shanok's shares were common ones, but a discount that big was unheard of. Avi decided to exercise his rights and told Esquivel he wanted to acquire the pro rata portion of Shanok's stock he was entitled to. The request did not go down well. A tense email exchange ensued between the two men that stretched into the Christmas holiday. At 11:17 p.m. on Christmas Eve, Esquivel sent Avi an email accusing him of acting in bad faith and warned him that Theranos was giving serious consideration to suing him for breach of his fiduciary duties as a board member and for public disparagement of the company. Avi was astonished. Not only had he done no such things, in all his years in Silicon Valley, he had never come close to being threatened with a lawsuit. All over the valley, he was known as a nice guy, a teddy bear. He didn't have any enemies. What was going on here? He tried getting in touch with other members of the board, but none would respond to his calls. Unsure what to do, Avi consulted a friend who was a lawyer. Thanks to his Apple wealth, his personal balance sheet was bigger than Theranos's, so the prospect of costly litigation didn't really scare him. But after he filled his friend in on everything that had happened, the friend asked a question that helped him put the situation in perspective. Given everything you now know about this company, do you really want to own more of it? When Avi thought about it, the answer was no. Besides,
It was the season of giving and rejoicing. He decided to let the matter rest and to put Theranos behind him. But before doing so, he wrote a parting letter to Don and emailed it to his assistants, along with a copy of the waiver the company had pressured him to sign. The brutal tactics used to get him to sign the waiver, he wrote, had confirmed some of the worst concerns he'd raised with Don about the way the company was being run. He didn't blame Michael Esquivel, he added, because it was clear the attorney was just acting on orders from above. He closed the letter with, "I do hope you will fully inform the rest of the board as to what happened here. They deserve to know that by not going along 100% with the program, they risk retribution from the company / Elizabeth." Warmly, Avi Tivanian. Chapter 4. Goodbye, East Poly. In early 2008, Theranos moved to a new building on Hillview Avenue in Palo Alto. It was the Silicon Valley equivalent of moving from the South Bronx to Midtown Manhattan. Appearances in the Valley are paramount, and for 3 years, Theranos had been operating on the wrong side of the tracks. The tracks, in this case, were Route 101, otherwise known as the Bayshore Freeway. It separates Palo Alto, one of the most affluent towns in America, from its poorer sibling, East Palo Alto, which once held the dubious distinction of being the country's murder capital. The company's old office was on the East Palo Alto side of the four-lane highway, next to a machine shop and across the street from a roofing contractor. It wasn't the type of neighborhood wealthy venture capitalists liked to be seen in. The new address, by contrast, was right next to the Stanford campus and around the corner from Hewlett-Packard's plush headquarters. It was pricey real estate that signaled Theranos was graduating to the big leagues. Don Lucas was pleased with the move. During a conversation with Tony Nugent, he made clear his disdain for the old location. "It's nice to finally get Elizabeth out of East Poly," he told Tony. The move was not fun for the person who had to make it happen, however. That job fell to Matt Bissell, the head of IT. Bissell was one of Elizabeth's most trusted lieutenants. He'd joined Theranos in 2005 as employee number 17 and took his duties seriously. In addition to being responsible for the company's IT infrastructure, his role also included security. He was the one who'd done the forensic analysis of the computer evidence for the Michael O'Connell lawsuit. Planning the move had taken up a big chunk of Matt's time over the past several months. On Thursday, January 31st, 2008, everything finally seemed ready. The movers were scheduled to arrive first thing the next morning to haul everything away. But at 4 that afternoon, Matt got pulled into a conference room with Michael Esquivel and Gary Frenzel. Elizabeth was conferenced in by phone from Switzerland, where she was conducting a second demonstration for Novartis some 14 months after the faked one that had led to Henry Moseley's departure. She'd just learned that the landlord would charge them rent for the month of February if they didn't clear the premises by midnight. There was no way she was going to let that happen, she said. She instructed Matt to call the moving company and have the movers come immediately. Matt thought the odds that would happen were very low, but agreed to try. He stepped out of the conference room and made the call. The moving company's dispatcher laughed at him. "No, sir. Rescheduling a corporate move at the 11th hour wasn't possible," he was told. Elizabeth was undeterred. She told Matt to call another moving company she had once used and to give them the job. Unlike the first company, this one wasn't unionized. She was sure it would be more flexible. But when Matt called the second moving company and explained the situation, a person there strongly advised him to drop the idea. Unionized moving companies were all mob-controlled, the person said. What Theranos was proposing to do risked devolving into violence. Even after hearing that sobering answer, Elizabeth wouldn't let it go. Matt and Gary tried to reason with her by citing other obstacles. Gary raised the issue of their stockpile of blood samples. Supposing they managed to get a crew to come that day, the movers wouldn't unload everything at the new address until tomorrow, he pointed out. How would they keep the blood at the proper temperature in the meantime? Elizabeth said they could use refrigerated trucks and keep them running in the parking lot overnight. After several crazed hours, Matt was finally able to talk some sense into her by pointing out that even if they somehow cleared the building by 11:59 p.m. that night, they would still have to conduct walkthroughs with state officials to demonstrate that they had properly disposed of any hazardous materials. Theranos was a biotech company, after all. Those walkthroughs would take weeks to schedule, and no new tenant would be able to move in until they had occurred. In the end, the move took place the next day as originally planned, but the episode was the final straw for Matt. Part of him admired Elizabeth. She was one of the smartest people he'd ever met, and she could be a really inspiring and energizing leader. He often joked that she could sell ice cream to Eskimos. But another part of him was tiring of her unpredictability and the constant chaos at the company. One aspect of Matt's job had become increasingly distasteful to him. Elizabeth demanded absolute loyalty from her employees, and if she sensed that she no longer had it from someone, she could turn on them in a flash. In Matt's 2.5 years at Theranos, he had seen her fire some 30 people, not counting the 20 or so employees who lost their jobs at the same time as Ed Koo when the microfluidic platform was abandoned. Every time Elizabeth fired someone, Matt had to assist with terminating the employee. Sometimes, that meant more than just revoking the departing employee's access to the corporate network and escorting him or her out of the building. In some instances, she asked him to build a dossier on the person that she could use for leverage. There was one case in particular that Matt regretted helping her with, that of Henry Moseley, the former chief financial officer. After Elizabeth fired Moseley, Matt had stumbled across inappropriate sexual material on his work laptop as he was transferring its files to a central server for safekeeping. When Elizabeth found out about it, she used it to claim it was the cause of Moseley's termination and to deny him stock options. Matt had reported to Moseley until he left and thought he'd done an excellent job of helping Elizabeth raise money for Theranos. He clearly shouldn't have browsed porn on a work-issued laptop, but Matt didn't think it was a capital offense that merited blackmailing him. And besides, it had been found after the fact. Saying it was the reason Moseley was fired simply wasn't true. The way John Howard was treated also bothered him. When Matt reviewed all the evidence assembled for the Michael O'Connell lawsuit, he didn't see anything proving that Howard had done anything wrong. He'd had contact with O'Connell, but he'd declined to join his company. Yet Elizabeth insisted on connecting the dots a certain way and suing him too, even though Howard had been one of the first people to help her when she dropped out of Stanford. Letting her use the basement of his house in Saratoga for experiments in the company's early days. Theranos later dropped the case against its 3 ex-employees when O'Connell agreed to sign his patent over to the company. Matt had long wanted to start his own IT consulting firm, and he decided this was the time to walk away and do it. When he informed Elizabeth of his decision, she looked at him in utter disbelief. She couldn't comprehend how he could possibly trade in a job at a company that was going to revolutionize healthcare and change the world for that. She tried to entice him to stay with a raise and a promotion, but he turned her down. During his last couple of weeks at Theranos, what Matt had seen happen to numerous other employees started happening to him. Elizabeth wouldn't speak to him anymore or even look at him. She offered one of his IT colleagues, Ed Ruiz, his position if Ed agreed to dig through Matt's files and emails. But Ed was good friends with Matt and refused. In any case, there was nothing to find. Matt was squeaky clean. Unlike Henry Moseley, he was able to keep his stock options and to exercise them. He left Theranos in February 2008 and started his own firm. Ed Ruiz joined him a few months later. Theranos's new office in Palo Alto was nice, but it was actually too big for a startup that had just shrunk back down to 50 people after the EdCo layoffs. The main floor was a long rectangular expanse. Elizabeth insisted on clustering employees on one side of it, leaving a big empty stretch of space on the other. Once or twice, Aaron Moore tried to put it to use by coaxing several colleagues into a game of indoor soccer. Aaron grew closer to Justin Maxwell and Mike Bowerly after Anna Ariola's sudden departure. Anna hadn't given any of them a heads up that she planned on quitting. She'd just marched out one day and hadn't come back. It unsettled Justin the most because Anna was the one who'd talked him into leaving Apple to come to Theranos, but he tried to maintain a positive attitude. He told himself that if the company was moving to prime Palo Alto office space, then it must be doing something right. Shortly after the move, Aaron and Mike decided to conduct some informal human factors research with two of the Edison prototypes Tony Nugent and Dave Nelson had built. It was engineering speak for putting them in people's hands and seeing how they interacted with them. Aaron was curious to know how people handled pricking their fingers and the subsequent steps required to get the blood into the cartridge. He'd pricked his own finger so much while running internal tests that he no longer had any feeling in it. With Tony's permission, they put the Edisons in the trunk of Aaron's Mazda and drove up to San Francisco. Their plan was to take them around to friends' startups in the city. First, they stopped at Aaron's apartment in San Francisco's Mission District to do some staging. They placed the machines on the wooden coffee table in Aaron's living room and made sure they had everything else they needed, the cartridges, the lancets to draw the blood, and the small syringes called transfer pens used to put the blood in the cartridge. Aaron took photos with his digital camera to document what they were doing. The Eve Behar cases weren't ready yet, so the devices had a primitive look. Their temporary cases were made from gray aluminum plates bolted together. The front plate tilted upward like a cat door to let the cartridge in. A rudimentary software interface sat atop the cat door at an angle. Inside, the robotic arm made loud grinding sounds. Sometimes it would crash against the cartridge and the pipette tips would snap off. The overall impression was that of an eighth-grade science project. When Aaron and Mike arrived at their friends' offices, they were greeted with chuckles and cups of coffee. Everyone was a good sport, though, and agreed to go along with their little experiment. One of the stops was at Bebo, a social networking startup that was acquired by AOL a few weeks later for $850 million. As the day progressed, it became apparent that one pinprick often wasn't enough to get the job done. Transferring the blood to the cartridge wasn't the easiest of procedures. The person had to swab his finger with alcohol, prick it with the lancet, apply the transfer pen to take the blood that bubbled up from the finger to aspirate it, and then press on the transfer pen's plunger to expel the blood into the cartridge. Few people got it right on their first try. Aaron and Mike kept having to ask their test subjects to prick themselves multiple times. It got messy. There was blood everywhere. These difficulties confirmed what Aaron already suspected. The company was underestimating this part of the process. To assume that a 55-year-old patient in his or her home was going to immediately master it was wishful thinking. And if you didn't get this part right, it didn't matter how well the rest of the system functioned, you weren't going to get good results. When they got back to the office, Aaron passed on his findings to Tony and Elizabeth, but he could tell they didn't think they were a priority. Aaron was getting frustrated and disillusioned. He'd initially bought into Elizabeth's vision and found work at Theranos exciting. But after nearly 2 years, he was getting burned out. Among other issues, he didn't get along with Tony, who'd become his boss. To get out from under him, he had asked to transfer from engineering to sales. He'd even spent a recent Saturday driving around shopping for a suit, in the hope that Elizabeth would let him tag along on her trip to Switzerland. She didn't, but she seemed to at least be taking his transfer request under advisement. A few days after the San Francisco excursion, Aaron was sipping a beer at home and downloading the pictures he'd taken when an idea for a joke came to him. Using Photoshop software, he took one of the pictures. It showed the twin Edison prototypes sitting side by side on dinner mats on his coffee table, and made a fake Craigslist ad. Above the photo and under a headline that read, "Theranos Edison 1.0 Readers, Mostly Functional, $10,000 or Best Offer," he wrote, "Up for grabs is a rare matching set of Theranos point-of-care diagnostic Edison devices. Billed as the iPod of healthcare, the Edison is a semi-portable immunochemistry platform capable of performing multiplexed protein assays on a fingerstick sample of human or animal whole blood. I bought these units recently when I thought I was at risk of succumbing to septic shock. Now that I've tested my protein C and realized that I'm safely in the 4 micrograms per milliliter range, I no longer need a pre-production blood analytic device. My loss is your gain. $10,000 for the pair, $6,000 apiece, or best offer. Would also be willing to consider trade for a comparable preclinical diagnostic device, i.e. Roche, Becton Coulter, Abaxis, Biosite, etc. Comes with a supply of single-use cartridges, Pelican shipping cases, AC adapter, EU power adapters, and assorted blood collection accessories, leeches, etc." Aaron printed out the mock ad and took it with him to work the next day. When Justin and Mike spotted it on his desk, they thought it was hilarious. Mike decided it deserved a bigger audience and posted it on the wall in the men's room. Then all hell broke loose. Someone took the ad down and brought it to Elizabeth, who thought it was real. She convened an emergency meeting of the senior managers and the lawyers. She was treating it as a full-blown case of industrial espionage and wanted an immediate investigation to find the culprit. Aaron decided he better fess up before things got further out of control. He sheepishly came forward and confessed to Tony. It was meant as an innocent prank, he explained. He thought people would find it amusing. Tony seemed understanding. He'd taken part in a few pranks of his own at Logitech when he worked there. But he warned Aaron that Elizabeth was furious. Later in the day, she called Aaron into her office and stared at him with dagger eyes. She was deeply disappointed in him, she told him. She didn't find his little stunt funny at all, and neither did other employees. It was disrespectful to the people who'd worked so hard to make the product. He could forget about joining the sales team. She couldn't put him in front of customers. This showed he represented the company poorly. Aaron went back to his cubicle with the knowledge that he was now squarely in Elizabeth's doghouse. A move to sales would probably have been ill-advised anyway. Unbeknownst to Aaron, trouble was brewing in that corner of the company. A new employee named Todd Surdy had come on board to head up sales and marketing, a role previously played by Elizabeth herself. Todd was the consummate sales executive. Before joining Theranos, he had worked at several established companies, including most recently the German enterprise software juggernaut, SAP. He was fit and good-looking, wore nice suits, and rolled up every day in a fancy BMW. During lunchtime, he pulled a carbon fiber road bike out of his trunk and went on rides in the nearby hills. Aaron liked to cycle too and accompanied Todd a few times in an attempt to buddy up to him before his prank put him in the penalty box with Elizabeth. Todd's two sales subordinates were based on the East Coast, where all the big pharmaceutical companies were headquartered. One of them was Susan DiGiamo, an employee who operated out of her home in New Jersey and had worked for Theranos for nearly 2 years. Susan had accompanied Elizabeth on numerous sales pitches to drug makers and had listened uncomfortably as she promised them the moon. When the drug makers' executives asked if the Theranos system could be customized to suit their needs, Elizabeth would always answer, "Absolutely." Soon after he started, Todd began asking Susan a lot of questions about the revenues Elizabeth was projecting from her deals with the drug makers. She kept a spreadsheet with detailed revenue forecasts. The numbers were big, in the tens of millions of dollars for each deal. Susan told Todd that, based on what she knew, they were vastly overinflated. Moreover, no significant revenues would materialize unless Theranos proved to each partner that its blood system worked. To that effect, each deal provided for an initial tryout, a so-called validation phase. Some companies, like the British drug maker AstraZeneca, weren't willing to pay more than $100,000 for the validation phase, and all could walk away if they weren't happy with the results. The 2007 study in Tennessee was the validation phase of the Pfizer contract. Its objective was to prove that Theranos could help Pfizer gauge cancer patients' response to drugs by measuring the blood concentration of three proteins the body produces in excess when tumors grow. If Theranos failed to establish any correlation between the patient's protein levels and the drugs, Pfizer could end their partnership, and any revenue forecast Elizabeth had extrapolated from the deal would turn out to be fiction. Susan also shared with Todd that she had never seen any validation data. And when she went on demonstrations with Elizabeth, the devices often malfunctioned. A case in point was the one they'd just conducted at Novartis. After the first Novartis demo in late 2006, during which Tim Kemp had beamed a fabricated result from California to Switzerland, Elizabeth had continued to court the drug maker and had arranged a second visit to its headquarters in January 2008. The night before that second meeting, Susan and Elizabeth had pricked their fingers for 2 hours in a hotel in Zurich to try to establish some consistency in the test results they were getting, to no avail. When they showed up at Novartis's Basel offices the next morning, it got worse. All three Edison readers produced error messages in front of a room full of Swiss executives. Susan was mortified, but Elizabeth kept her composure and blamed a minor technical glitch. Based on the intel he was getting from Susan and from other employees in Palo Alto, Todd became convinced that Theranos' board was being misled about the company's finances and the state of its technology. He took his concerns to Michael Esquivel, the general counsel with whom he had established good rapport. Michael, it turned out, was developing his own suspicions. During a lunchtime run with a colleague from the new office to the Stanford Dish and back, he mentioned not feeling too good about Theranos' pharmaceutical partnerships. He wouldn't say more, but the colleague could tell something was bothering him. In March 2008, Todd and Michael approached Tom Brodeen, one of Theranos' board members, and told him the revenue projections Elizabeth was touting to the board weren't grounded in reality. They were hugely exaggerated and impossible to reconcile with the unfinished state of the product, they said. Brodeen was a seasoned businessman in his mid-60s who had headed one of the big consulting firms as well as several technology companies. He hadn't been on the Theranos board long, having joined at the request of Don Lucas in the fall of 2007. Given how new he was as a director, he advised Todd and Michael to take their account directly to Lucas, the board's chairman. Coming just months after Avi Tivanian had raised similar concerns, Lucas took the matter seriously this time. In a way, he couldn't afford not to. Todd was the son-in-law of one of Theranos' investors, the venture capitalist B.J. Kasson. Kasson and Lucas were longtime friends. They had both invested in Theranos at the same time, during the startup's Series B round in early 2006. Lucas convened an emergency meeting of the board in his office on Sand Hill Road. Elizabeth was asked to wait outside the door while the other directors, Lucas, Brodeen, Channing Robertson, and Peter Thomas, the founder of an early-stage venture capital firm called ATA Ventures, conferred inside. After some discussion, the four men reached a consensus. They would remove Elizabeth as CEO. She had proven herself too young and inexperienced for the job. Tom Brodeen would step in to lead the company for a temporary period until a more permanent replacement could be found. They called in Elizabeth to confront her with what they had learned and inform her of their decision. But then, something extraordinary happened. Over the course of the next 2 hours, Elizabeth convinced them to change their minds. She told them she recognized there were issues with her management and promised to change. She would be more transparent and responsive going forward. It wouldn't happen again. Brodeen wasn't exactly dying to come out of retirement to run a startup in a field in which he had no expertise, so he took a neutral stance and watched as Elizabeth used just the right mix of contrition and charm to gradually win back his three board colleagues. It was an impressive performance, he thought. A much older and more experienced CEO skilled in the art of corporate infighting would have been hard-pressed to turn the situation around like she had. He was reminded of an old saying, "When you strike at the king, you must kill him." Todd Surdy and Michael Esquivel had struck at the king, or rather, the queen. But she'd survived. The queen didn't waste any time putting down the rebellion. Elizabeth fired Surdy first and Esquivel a few weeks later. To Aaron Moore, Mike Bowerly, and Justin Maxwell, this new purge was one more negative development. They weren't privy to what had happened, but they did know that Theranos had lost two good employees. Todd and Michael weren't just nice guys they got along with, they were smart and principled colleagues. In Mike Bowerly's words, they were cut from good cloth. The firings caused Justin to further sour on Theranos. The staff turnover was like nothing he'd ever experienced before, and he was troubled by what he saw as a culture of dishonesty at the company. The worst offender was Tim Kemp, the head of the software team. Tim was a yes man, who never leveled with Elizabeth about what was feasible and what wasn't. For instance, he'd contradicted Justin and assured her they could write the Edison software's user interface faster in Flash than in JavaScript. The very next morning, Justin had spotted a Learn Flash book on his desk. Elizabeth never reprimanded Tim, even when obvious examples of his duplicity were brought to her attention. She valued his loyalty, and in her eyes, the fact that he never said no to her reflected a can-do attitude. It mattered little that many of his colleagues thought Tim was a mediocrity and a terrible manager. There was one incident involving Elizabeth herself that also didn't sit well with Justin. During an email exchange one evening, he asked her for a piece of information he needed to write a section of software. She responded that she'd look for it when she was back at work the next morning. The clear implication was that she had gone home. But minutes later, he stumbled on her in Tony Nugent's office down the hall. Justin got angry and stormed off. Elizabeth came by his office a little later to say she understood why he was upset, but she warned him, "Don't ever walk off on me again." Justin tried to remind himself that Elizabeth was very young and still had a lot to learn about running a company. In one of their last email exchanges, he recommended two management self-help books to her, The No Asshole Rule, Building a Civilized Workplace and Surviving One That Isn't, and Beyond Bullshit, Straight Talk at Work, and included their links on Amazon.com. He quit 2 days later. His resignation email read in part,
Good luck, and please do read those books, watch The Office, and believe in the people who disagree with you. Lying is a disgusting habit, and it flows through the conversations here like it's our own currency. The cultural disease here is what we should be curing before we try to tackle obesity. I mean no ill will towards you.